make a perestroika of its own and elect a supervisory science and technology council. Legasov, citing his poor health and also recognizing that votes against him could jeopardize his path to succeed Alexandrov as director, did not wish to stand. But Alexandrov insisted, and when the results were declared, Legasov discovered how little he understood his colleagues' feelings about him. Of the 229 votes, only 100 had been cast in his favor. 129 were against. Legasov was thunderstruck. At 50, it was the first reversal of his gilded career. At a meeting of his party cell on June 10, old man Alexandrov had better news to report. He told the room that they should congratulate Legasov. The director explained that he had seen the final list of those who would be honored by the Politburo for their heroism in Chernobyl, and the name of his first deputy was near the top. Legasov would be granted the one award that had so far eluded him and made a hero of socialist labor. But when the final list was published, Legasov's name was no longer on it. Word went around that Gorbachev had decided at the last minute that no one from Kurchatov should receive a state award for actions in containing a disaster that the Institute had helped precipitate. The following day, Legasov phoned his secretary from home. Before he ended the call, he asked her to look out for his two children, and she became concerned. Colleagues hurried to the house on Pyotnia 26, where Legasov was found unconscious, a bottle of sleeping pills at his side. Although rescued from his attempted suicide, Legasov returned to work profoundly changed. The playful light in his eyes had dimmed, and he shuffled up the stairs like an old man. Attending a scientific conference in England that summer, he met his old friend and Pravda science editor Vladimir Guberev, whose play Sarcophagus was being performed at the National Theatre in London. Guberev tried to encourage the academician to make the most of the foreign trip, to find some girls or perhaps see the West End production of Cats. But Legasov wanted only to get back to his hotel. That autumn, for the first time, he began reading the Bible. Using a new Japanese dictaphone he received as a gift from an old friend, he made a series of tape recordings about his experience in Chernobyl, gathering material for a memoir. But he told those close to him that his career was finished. He tried, unsuccessfully, to commit suicide again. Afterward, Guberev attempted to raise his friend's spirits by suggesting he articulate his ideas about nuclear safety in an article for Pravda. Legasov finished the piece in a matter of days, and once it was published, called Guberev every day for news on how it had been received. When this, too, was ignored, Legasov took a more drastic step. He gave an interview to the liberal literary journal Novy Mir, in which he warned that, contrary to everything he had said before, another Chernobyl catastrophe could occur at any one of the other RBMK stations in the USSR at any time. He told the reporter that many scientists were aware of the danger, but no one would act to stop it. In a separate interview with Unost, another Soviet journal where the shackles of censorship were being loosened by Glasnost, Legasov went further still. Turning his back on every political orthodoxy he had believed in since he was a teenager, the academician said that Soviet science had lost its way. The men and women behind the great triumphs of Soviet technology, who had created the first nuclear power plant and launched Yuri Gagarin into space, had been striving for a new and better society and acted with a morality and strength of purpose inherited from Pushkin and Tolstoy. But the thread of virtuous purpose had run through their fingers, leaving behind a generation of young people who were technologically sophisticated but morally untethered. It was this profound failure of the Soviet social experiment, and not merely a handful of reckless reactor operators, that Legasov believed was to blame for the catastrophe that had bloomed from reactor number 4. By the beginning of 1988, Legasov had given up hope of ever succeeding Alexandrov as director of the Kurchatov Institute of Atomic Energy. Instead, as Gorbachev's reforms gathered pace and public criticism of the state increased, the academician organized a council on ecology and proposed to set up his own Institute of Nuclear Safety, an autonomous body that would bring truly independent regulation to the Soviet atomic industry. He submitted his plans to the Academy of Sciences, optimistic that they would be approved in recognition, if nothing else, of his role in liquidating the consequences of the greatest nuclear accident in history. But when the hearings were finally held toward the end of April, his mentor, Alexandrov, gave the idea only tepid support and Legosov's proposal was declined. The academician received the news on April 26, 1988, exactly 2 years to the day after the accident. That afternoon, Legosov's daughter, Inga, picked up her son from kindergarten as usual. When they reached home, she was delighted to find her father waiting beside his car outside the entrance to her apartment building. Inga invited him upstairs for something to eat, but he said he had to go. "I'm coming from the Academy of Sciences," he said. "I just dropped by for a moment to look at you." It was the last time she saw him alive. At lunchtime the next day, Legosov's son, Alexei, returned from work to the family home at Pehotnia 26 and discovered his father's body hanging in the stairwell, a noose around his neck. He had left no note. When a colleague from the Kurchatov Institute checked Legosov's office for radioactivity, he found every one of his belongings too contaminated to be returned to his family. Gathered into a series of large plastic bags, they were buried instead. Soon afterward, when an official visited Anatoly Alexandrov in his office to discuss candidates to assume some of Legosov's duties, the 85-year-old director broke down and cried. "Why did he abandon me?" he said. "Oh, why did he abandon me?" 2 weeks after Legosov's death, the Soviet Minister of Health delivered the opening address of an international conference on the medical consequences of the accident, convened in Kiev and attended by representatives of the International Atomic Energy Agency and the World Health Organization, WHO. For the first time, Soviet scientists admitted that 17.5 million people, including 2.5 million children under 7, had lived in the most seriously contaminated areas of Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia at the time of the disaster. Of these, 696,000 had been examined by Soviet medical authorities by the end of 1986. Yet the official tally of deaths ascribed to the disaster to date remained the same as that announced the previous year, 31. The health minister said that they had not discovered a single case of injury in the general population due to radiation. "One must say definitely," he told the assembled delegates, "that we can today be certain there are no effects of the Chernobyl accident on human health." But the citizens of the Soviet Union no longer trusted their scientists. In Kiev, even 2 years after the accident, young couples were afraid to have children, and people ascribed every kind of minor illness to the effects of radiation. Ukrainian Pravda began publishing what it promised would be weekly reports on radioactivity in the three major cities nearest to the station, updated regularly like the weather forecast. But the mandarins of the atomic industry still failed to appreciate the degree to which they had lost the public's confidence. Accustomed to their place as revered icons of the socialist utopia, they found themselves regarded with suspicion and enmity, yet clung to their convictions with righteous disdain. Speaking at a press conference on the closing day of the medical conference in Kiev, the head of the Soviet Institute of Biophysics chastised those scientists who had publicly predicted that thousands of cancers would develop as a result of the accident. "They inflict great damages because they forget there are many variables," he said. "We never speak of any number of cases. That is immoral." He dismissed reports of illnesses caused by the long-term consequences of the explosion as the result of a new psychological syndrome, which he called radiophobia. For the final rulers of the USSR, the most destructive forces unleashed by the explosion of reactor number 4 were not radiological, but political and economic. The cloud of radiation that spread out across Europe, making the catastrophe impossible to conceal, had forced the touted openness of Gorbachev's glasnost on even the most reluctant conservatives in the Politburo. And the General Secretary's own realization that even the nuclear bureaucracy had been undermined by secrecy, incompetence, and stagnation convinced him that the entire state was rotten. After the accident, frustrated and angry, he confronted the need for truly drastic change and plunged deeply into perestroika in a desperate bid to rescue the socialist experiment before it was too late. But once the party relaxed its rigid grip on information, it proved impossible to fully regain its former levels of control. What began with more open reporting from Chernobyl, the news stories in Pravda and Izvestia were followed by TV documentaries and personal testimonies in popular magazines, widened to include open discussion of long-censored social issues, including drug addiction, the abortion epidemic, the Afghan War, and the horrors of Stalinism. Slowly at first, but then with gathering momentum, the Soviet public began to discover how deeply it had been misled, not only about the accident and its consequences, but also about the ideology and identity upon which their society was founded. The accident and the government's inability to protect the population from its consequences finally shattered the illusion that the USSR was a global superpower armed with technology that led the world. And as the state's attempts to conceal the truth of what had happened came to light, even the most faithful citizens of the Soviet Union faced the realization that their leaders were corrupt and that the communist dream was a sham. Soon after Valery Legasov's suicide, Pravda published an edited extract of the Chernobyl memoir the academician had recorded on tape, in which he described the hopeless lack of preparation for the catastrophe and the long history of safety failures that had led up to it. After I had visited Chernobyl NPP, I came to the conclusion that the accident was the inevitable apotheosis of the economic system which had been developed in the USSR over many decades, he wrote in a testament that appeared under the headline, "It's My Duty to Say This." By September 1988, in a sign of how quickly the system was changing, the Politburo had bowed to public concern and abandoned work on two new nuclear plants, even though one of them, on the outskirts of Minsk, was almost complete. 10 months later, the Soviet nuclear engineer Grigory Medvedev published a sensational exposé of the accident in Novy Mir. In spite of glasnost, it had taken Medvedev 2 years to get his account into print, fighting a clandestine battle against the KGB and a Chernobyl censorship commission organized specifically to keep the most sensitive information about the accident from the public. Behind that stood Boris Shcherbina, the chairman of the government commission, who rightly feared what Medvedev would reveal about his actions in Pripyat. A minute-by-minute reconstruction of the events of April 26, based on his own visits to the scene and dozens of interviews with witnesses, Medvedev's Chernobyl notebook was explosive. It depicted Viktor Bruhanov as a spineless fool, the mandarins of the Soviet nuclear industry as callous and incompetent, and showed Shcherbina unnecessarily delaying the evacuation of the doomed Atomgrad. An introduction to the story was provided by the USSR's most famous dissident, Andrei Sakharov, recently released from internal exile by Gorbachev. In a letter he personally addressed to the General Secretary, Sakharov had threatened that if the Central Committee did not allow Medvedev's story to be published, he would personally see to it that the information it contained was disseminated as widely as possible. Everything that pertains to the Chernobyl disaster, its causes and consequences, must become the property of Glasnost, Sakharov wrote in his introduction. The complete and naked truth is necessary. In February 1989, almost 3 years after the accident, a primetime report on Vremya revealed to the Soviet people that the true extent of radioactive contamination beyond the perimeter of the 30-kilometer exclusion zone had been covered up, and that the total area of contamination outside the zone was, in fact, even larger than that within it. Glasnost wins after all is the way we might begin this story, the correspondent said, standing in front of multicolored maps showing that the most heavily radioactive hotspots lay as far as 300 kilometers from the station, across the border in Belarus, in the districts of Gomel and Mogilev, where witnesses had watched black rain fall in April and May 1986. The land was so poisoned that the Belarusian government estimated another 100,000 people would have to be evacuated and planned to request the equivalent of $16 billion in further aid from Moscow. A few weeks later, just as the last Soviet troops slunk home in defeat from Afghanistan and amid worsening news about the domestic economy, General Secretary Gorbachev traveled to the scene of the accident for the first time. He pulled on a white coat and protective cap to tour reactor number 2 of the Chernobyl plant, his wife Reza at his side, and visited Slavutich. In Kiev, he spoke to party officials, announcing a program to protect the environment and promised to hold a public referendum on any controversial new projects. He pleaded for patience with the growing shortages and the faltering economy, and warned that any Soviet republics thinking of leaving the Union were playing with fire. But environmental issues were already becoming a focal point for nascent independence movements in Latvia and Estonia, and would soon provide a platform for Zelenyi Svit, the Green World opposition party in Ukraine. When Gorbachev climbed from his limousine in Kiev for one of his choreographed walkabouts and began to talk about the need to support perestroika, the crowd veered off script. "People are afraid," one woman told him. When he tried to respond, another woman interrupted the General Secretary to ask his view of two nuclear reactors under construction in Crimea. As the third anniversary of the disaster approached, Moscow News reported from a collective farm in the Zhytomyr region of Ukraine, 40 kilometers west of the exclusion zone, where radioactive hotspots of strontium-90 and cesium-137 had been discovered. Farmers in the area had observed a steep rise in the number of birth defects in their livestock since the accident, describing piglets with frog-like eyes and malformed skulls, and calves born without legs, eyes, or heads. One member of a team visiting from the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences in Kiev told the press their findings were terrifying and insisted the region be evacuated immediately. A representative from the Kurcharov Institute dismissed any connection between such deformities and the accident, blaming excessive use of fertilizers and improper farming methods instead. In October 1989, the newspaper Sovietska Russia reported that hundreds of tons of pork and beef contaminated with radioactive cesium had been secretly mixed into sausages and sold to unsuspecting shoppers throughout the Soviet Union in the years since 1986. Although the workers at the meat factory responsible had been paid a bonus to compensate them for their exposure to radiation, a follow-up report to the Politburo insisted that the Chernobyl sausage was perfectly safe to eat and had been processed in strict accordance with the recommendations of the Ministry of Health of the USSR. Inside the zone, as thousands of soldiers continued to scour the landscape of radionuclides, bulldoze ancient settlements into the ground, and toss contaminated furniture from the windows of apartments in Pripyat, scientists began to notice strange new phenomena in the wildlife they found there. Hedgehogs, voles, and shrews had become radioactive, and mallards had developed genetic abnormalities. In the cooling reservoir of the plant, silver carp grew to monstrous sizes. The leaves of the trees around the Red Forest had swelled to supernatural proportions, including giant conifers with pine needles 10 times their usual size, and acacias with blades as large as a child's palm. The authorities announced their intention to set up a wildlife preserve in Belarus and an international research center inside the zone to study the long-term effects of radiation on the environment. But money was short. The Soviet economy, after decades of spending on the Cold War arms race, was now staggering under the burden of the botched market reforms of Gorbachev's perestroika, the high price of withdrawing and demobilizing troops from Afghanistan, and the collapse in the international oil market. And the financial cost of Chernobyl, the irradiation and destruction of equipment, the evacuations, the medical care, and the loss of factories, farmland, and millions of kilowatts of electricity, continued to rise. The price for the construction and operation of the sarcophagus alone was 4 billion rubles, or almost $5.5 billion. One estimate put the eventual bill for all aspects of the disaster at more than $128 billion, the equivalent to the total Soviet defense budget for 1989. The bleeding was slow but proved impossible to stanch, one more open wound that the state could no longer shrug off as the Soviet colossus sank slowly to its knees. In July 1989, Gorbachev gave a speech signaling to the people of the Soviet satellite countries of Eastern Europe, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Romania, and the rest, that he would not intervene if they chose to unseat their leaders or even break with the Brotherhood of Socialism altogether. 4 months later, the Berlin Wall fell, and the Soviet Empire began to unravel. Within the borders of the USSR, ethnic division and opposition to Moscow rule gathered pace amid chronic shortages and an imploding economy. Riots and civil disobedience roiled through the 15 Soviet republics. In Lithuania, 6,000 people encircled the Ignalina nuclear power plant, where the two new RBMK 1500 reactors had become a target of nationalist anger, triggering the start of protests that soon led the three Baltic states to declare independence from the Union. In Minsk, a reported 80,000 people marched on the headquarters of the Belarusian government, demanding to be relocated from contaminated territory. "Our leaders have been lying to us for 3 years," one participant told a Soviet reporter. "And now they've deserted this land, damned by God and Chernobyl." In the West, public confidence in nuclear energy, which had never fully recovered after Three Mile Island, was finally shattered by the explosion in Reactor No. 4. The disaster unleashed a wave of popular mistrust, and opposition to the industry spread across the globe. In the 12 months following the accident, the governments of Sweden, Denmark, Austria, New Zealand, and the Philippines all pledged to permanently abandon their nuclear programs, and 9 other nations either canceled or delayed plans for further reactor construction. Opinion polls suggested that since Chernobyl, 2/3 of people around the world opposed any further development of nuclear energy. The United States faced a complete collapse in reactor building, and the very name of the Ukrainian plant became embedded in the international lexicon as shorthand for the failings of technology and a well-justified suspicion of official information. In Ukraine, the Soviet Ministry of Energy's continuing construction of new nuclear power stations had become a focal point of regional opposition to Moscow. When Kiev called for an end to work on the controversial plant in Crimea, building went on regardless, until the local authorities sanctioned strikes and cut off funding for the project at the state bank. On March 1, 1990, the Supreme Soviet of Ukraine passed a series of sweeping environmental protections for the republic. Among them, an agreement to close down all 3 of the remaining reactors at Chernobyl plant within 5 years. On August 2, Republican legislators placed a moratorium on the construction of any new nuclear plants in Ukraine. In Moscow, the Ministry of Energy was forced to consider who would control the Soviet Union's network of nuclear plants if its union-wide decision-making power was suddenly devolved to the republics. In the exclusion zone, hundreds of thousands of tons of debris from the reactor, radioactive soil, vegetation, furniture, cars, and equipment, had now been interred in roughly 800 waste disposal sites known as mogilniki, or burial grounds, concrete-lined trenches, pits, and mounds, sprayed with polymer solutions and then seeded with grass. But the warren of nuclear dumps had been hurriedly excavated and poorly maintained. Nobody had bothered to keep track of what had been buried where, and by the beginning of 1990, the liquidation was being starved of manpower. Even offered twice the average Soviet salary and bonus payments paid directly into their bank accounts, when military reservists were told they were being sent to Chernobyl, many refused to go. The continued mobilizations created a public outcry, and at last, the Soviet military authorities decided to stop sending troops to the zone. In December 1990, the liquidation effectively came to a halt. By the end, it was almost impossible to calculate the total number of liquidators who served in the Forbidden Zone, in part because the figures were falsified by the Soviet government. By the beginning of 1991, as many as 600,000 men and women from across the Soviet Union had taken part in cleanup work in the radioactive netherworld surrounding the site of Reactor No. 4 and would be officially recognized as Chernobyl liquidators. In acknowledgement of their service, many were issued special identity cards and an enameled medal depicting the Greek letters for Alpha, Beta, and Gamma surrounding a scarlet drop of blood. All understood that, as with the veterans of the Great Patriotic War, their sacrifices had earned them a lifetime of care from their motherland. In Kiev, the Soviet Ministry of Health set up a dedicated clinic, the All-Union Radiation Medicine Research Center, to provide treatment for anyone who had been exposed to radiation. But as the first of the demobilized liquidators began to fall ill, arriving in clinics with complaints that seemed inexplicable, unpredictable, or premature, they found the state's doctors reluctant to connect their symptoms to the conditions they had endured inside the 30-kilometer zone. The bankrupt state could ill afford to provide the specialist care it had promised to more than 500,000 new potential invalids, and so doctors wrote up their notes in code. Their medical records were classified as secret. All but the most extreme cases were dismissed with the same diagnosis given to Maria Pratsenko: ordinary illness not related to ionizing radiation. Early in December 1991, in a national referendum called by the parliament in Kiev 4 months earlier, the Ukrainian people voted to declare independence from the USSR, and Mikhail Gorbachev lost the battle to hold together the union of the 12 remaining Soviet republics. Returned briefly to his position as head of state after a failed reactionary coup in August, he had been forced to watch as Russian President Boris Yeltsin stripped him of his powers and announced that he was suspending the activities of the Communist Party. On Christmas Day, Gorbachev appeared on television to deliver an emotional resignation address, and the red banner of the Soviet Union was lowered for the last time from the flagpole above the Kremlin. Amid the chaos of the collapsing empire, most of the men and women who had fought the Battle of Chernobyl were forgotten, the final defenders of a nation that had seemingly vanished overnight. In the years that followed, many of those who had lived through the catastrophe became invalids in middle age, struck down by mysterious clusters of symptoms including high blood pressure, cataracts, kidney trouble, and chronic fatigue. Captain Sergei Volodin, the first helicopter pilot on the scene, who had inadvertently flown his machine through the plume of radioactive vapor rising from the reactor, developed a fear of heights and took an Air Force desk job. Those unable to work at all subsisted on diminishing state pensions and struggled to find medical care. Some died of heart disease and blood disorders, including leukemia, in hospitals in Kiev and Moscow. Major Telyatnikov, who commanded the firefighters on the night of the accident, was killed by cancer of the jaw in December 2004 at the age of 53. For others, the psychological burden of enduring the disaster only to be set helplessly adrift in a world so abruptly transformed proved too much to bear. The electrical engineer Andrei Tormozin, who had miraculously survived exposure to apparently lethal levels of radiation, a failed bone marrow transplant, and blood poisoning, emerged alive from hospital number 6, but afterward sank into depression and drank himself to death. Almost 2 decades after the accident, in February 2006, in a desolate cafe near the apartment block where he lived in Kiev, I met the physicist Vinyamin Prianichnikov. A big man, wearing a 3-piece suit and a polka-dot tie, 62 years old, he was animated and emphatic, his speech rich with metaphor and arid humor. He recalled with exacting clarity the flecks of graphite on the leaves of his wife's strawberry plants and the fight against the China syndrome in the basement of Unit 4. Of the 5 men who had gathered temperature and radiation readings from the bowels of the reactor in the most terrifying days of May 1986, he told me that 4 were already dead. "So 20% survived," he said with a dark smile, "if you include me." The liquidators who lived on did so with the fear that they'd returned from the battlefield with fatal wounds no one could ever see. "We know that the invisible enemy is eating away inside us like a worm," said General Nikolai Antoshkin, whose helicopter crews fought to extinguish the nuclear inferno. "For us, the war continues, and little by little, we are slipping away from this world." When I visited Alexander and Natalia Yuvchenko in their apartment not far from Moscow State University in 2006, the engineer's arms and back were scarred violet red with the results of skin grafting operations so numerous he had stopped counting at 15. He'd gone back to work as quickly as he could after being discharged from hospital number 6, but later spent weeks in a hospital in Germany being treated by military doctors and still had to undergo 2 weeks of medical testing every year. Yuvchenko had recently started a new job that returned him to his chosen field, nuclear engineering, for the first time since 1986. He was delighted to be able to make business trips to Ukraine, where he visited the country's remaining atomic power stations and worked once more with the same colleagues he had known since his days at university in Odessa. Yet when he began to talk about the accident, rivulets of sweat ran through his close-cropped hair, and the handkerchief he kneaded in his fist was soon soaked through. Yuvchenko didn't know if the radiation made him infertile, although the doctors assured the couple that they could safely have had more children. But Natalia didn't trust them and questioned their motives. She didn't want to become the unwitting subject of some callous experimental study. So their son Kirill, then studying to become a doctor, remained an only child, and they had adopted a Siamese cat named Charlie, born on April 26, which they agreed was a good omen. But Alexander said that the effects the radiation had on his health weren't as bad as people might have imagined. "The doctors keep telling me I've survived, so I can carry on now without worrying," he said. "But when I went back to Ukraine, they started telling me about people who had died. Was it due to radiation? I don't know. I don't understand anything about statistics. But when my friends ask me about it, I tell them, the less you think about it, the longer you'll live." 19. The Elephant's Foot. The afternoon of Monday, April 25, 2016, was beautiful and warm in Pripyat, more like summer than spring. The city was still and empty. Poplar seeds floated and danced on the breeze, the heavy green silence broken only by birdsong. Almost exactly 30 years after the explosion of Unit 4, the Atomgrad that Viktor Bruhanov conjured from an empty field was finally being reconquered by nature. The fine Baltic roses planted on the director's orders had long ago run wild, and their blackened hips rotted in a ragged tangle of bushes in the middle of the city square. A forest of willow, pine, and wild pear filled the soccer stadium. A single silver birch sapling burst from the shattered front steps of the White House, and clusters of oak and acacia had transformed a broad stretch of Kurchatov Street into a dappled woodland path. On the lampposts, the hammer and sickle symbols endured, but the Soviet stars were rusted and bent, pushed aside by thrusting branches, and the images on the crosswalk signs had been erased by decades of sun and rain. A blanket of thick moss stretched beneath the disintegrating Ferris wheel. Open to the elements, attacked by water, frost, and corrosive lichens, many of the buildings of the city were in danger of collapse. On Sportivnaya Street, the entrance to one apartment house was cut off by massive panels of fallen concrete. Looters and scavengers had stripped the city of almost every piece of metal they could find, leaving behind rooms furnished only with the dark silhouettes of vanished radiators and holes in the streets where they had torn steel pipes and cables from deep underground. In the blocks on Lenina Prospect, the stairwells were carpeted with broken glass and paper curled from the bedroom walls in limp sheets, powdery and leached of color. On the fourth floor of building 13/34, overlooking Kurchatov Street, the front door of Bruhanov's family home had been torn from its hinges and lay in the hallway beneath a heavy coat of pale gray dust. The big corner apartment was almost bare, and there was little evidence of who had once lived there. A child's picture of a vintage car stuck to the tiles in the darkened bathroom, a single high-heeled shoe on the kitchen floor. But from the balcony of a room overlooking the square, the words on the roof of the 10-story apartment block opposite were still just visible above the trees. Haibude atom robotnikam, ane soldatam. Let the atom be a worker, not a soldier. 3 kilometers away, the construction cranes above reactors 5 and 6 of the Chernobyl plant remained frozen where they had stopped when work there was abandoned on the night of the accident. But inside the main part of the power station, a skeleton staff labored on. When the newly independent Republic of Ukraine began receiving its first bills for electricity generated in Russia, the government reversed its decision to close the plant's remaining 3 reactors, and the last of them was not finally shut down until 2000. Since then, a dwindling workforce had tended to the cooling, decommissioning, and dismantling of Units 1, 2, and 3, commuting to work every day on a dedicated electric train from an hour away in Slavutich. When I first visited the Chernobyl station, one morning in the depths of winter, the heating had stopped working and the inside of the complex was bitterly cold. Up on Mark Plus 10, on the dirty side of the sanitary lock, a light snow blew past the windows, and 2 men in white overalls and thick coats walked briskly down the deaerator corridor, their breath condensing into clouds. In control room number 2, 3 engineers stood around their desks, smoking cigarettes and making murmured telephone calls. Many of the dials and annunciator alarms on the desk were plastered with paper labels, printed with the legend, "Taken out of service." In the center of the mothballed control panel that had once twitched constantly with readouts from the reactor, a small color television screen displayed closed-circuit images from the machine hall, where the giant turbines were being slowly dismantled. Farther west, down the long corridor that once connected all 4 of the plant's reactor units, the skeleton staff melted away. Inside the dormant hulk of Unit 3, an oppressive quiet gathered in the dim machine rooms. The floors were still covered with the yellowing plastic mats laid during decontamination in 1986. Drab, gray light seeped through the filthy glazing, heavy pipework hung from the ceiling, and a tang of machine oil and ozone lingered in the damp air. Down one more staircase and along a windowless corridor, it became impossible to go farther. The presence of something close by but unseen, something monstrous, became almost tangible. The cluster of thick pipes running overhead came to a sudden halt, their severed ends hanging in the air just short of what had once been the entrance to a passageway, now sealed with solid concrete. Against this wall, surrounded by a puddle of milky liquid, stood a red marble monument bearing a bronze bas-relief. The dark shape of a man wearing the cylindrical cap of a power plant worker, one arm outstretched in alarm, as if reaching for help that would never come. This was the tombstone of Valery Khademchuk, the first man to die as a result of the explosion in Unit 4. His surviving colleagues had built the memorial as close as they dared to the place where they believed his body lay buried. Whatever remained of the vanished machinist lay immediately beyond this point, on the other side of 3 meters of concrete and a layer of lead, beneath thousands of tons of rubble, sand, and twisted debris. Somewhere in there with him, too, was the melted heart of Reactor Number 4, a protean mass of uranium, zirconium, and other core elements that remained almost as enigmatic and deadly as it was on the day the catastrophe began, almost 30 years before. From the very start, the small band of Kurchatov Institute specialists who began exploring inside the rising sarcophagus in the summer of 1986 had faced terrible obstacles. Sent from Moscow to locate the hundreds of tons of nuclear fuel that had once fired Reactor 4, they were hampered by fields of gamma radiation, collapsed wreckage, cascades of freshly pumped shred mesh concrete, and malfunctioning equipment. Attempts to use robots initially ended in the same way as so many others had in the special zone. At its first test, one device, created at enormous expense to explore the ruins, proved incapable of navigating even minor obstructions. It had to be rescued repeatedly by its operators, and ultimately stopped dead in a high radiation zone. In a scene captured on video and screened that night before the assembled task force, the robot then unexpectedly came back to life and, in a ridiculous pantomime of flashing lights and waving appendages, fled down the corridor before it screeched and fell on its side and had to be retrieved by its handlers in a blizzard of invective. Eventually, rudimentary reconnaissance began with the help of a miniature plastic tank bought by one of the scientists for 12 rubles, the equivalent then of $5, from the toy store Detsky Mir, Children's World in Kiev. The toy was controlled by a battery-operated box on the end of a long cable and modified to carry a dosimeter, a thermometer, and a powerful flashlight. The scientists used it like a radio-sensitive hunting dog, which ran 10 meters ahead of them and warned of imminent danger. Although fully aware of the perils surrounding them, the members of the Kurchatov Task Force were urged on by the gravity of their search for the missing fuel, necessary to guarantee that a new chain reaction could not begin, but also by scientific curiosity. Inside the sarcophagus, they were explorers on the frontier of an alien world, where they found gamma radiation fields scaling heights no one had witnessed before, and strange new materials forged at temperatures of more than 10,000 degrees centigrade in the crucible of a disintegrating nuclear reactor. In the autumn of 1986, the members of the Kurchatov team made one of their first and most memorable discoveries when they finally entered the mysterious Corridor 217-2, where months before their remote radiation probe had run off the scale and burned out. To reach it, the scientists now wriggled through a narrow tunnel formed in the ruins, armed with flashlights and clad in thin plastic suits to protect them from radioactive dust. What they found there was a massive, globular, stalagmite-like formation of some mysterious substance. It appeared to have flowed down from somewhere above their heads before solidifying into an anthracite-black, glassy mass. The formation, which they named the Elephant's Foot, stood taller than a man and weighed as much as 2 tons. Its surface was emitting an astonishing 8,000 Rntgen per hour, or 2 Rntgen a second. 5 minutes in its presence was enough to guarantee an agonizing death. Nonetheless, orders came down from the government commission for photographs and a full analysis. Unable to find the fuel from the reactor, the scientists had also found no sign so far of the more than 16,000 tons of materials dropped into the reactor by General Antoshkin's heroic helicopter crews, and therefore hoped that the Elephant's Foot might contain some of the lead intended to cool the core. But it did not readily surrender samples for testing. The substance proved too hard for a drill mounted on a motorized trolley, and a soldier who volunteered to attack it with an axe left the room empty-handed, and so overexposed he had to be evacuated immediately from Chernobyl. Finally, a police marksman arrived and shot a fragment of the surface away with a rifle. The sample revealed that the elephant's foot was a solidified mass of silicon dioxide, titanium, zirconium, magnesium, and uranium. A once molten radioactive lava containing all the radionuclides found in irradiated nuclear fuel that had somehow flowed into the corridor from the rooms nearby. But it contained no trace of the lead dropped into Unit 4 from the air during the frantic early days of May. By measuring the temperature of the air inside the subreactor spaces, the Kurchatov experts found evidence that there might be more lava, still hot from the energy of radioactive decay, in the room at the end of the corridor, which had housed the gigantic stainless steel cross, structure S, supporting the reactor vessel and everything in it. But once again, they found their path blocked by rubble and radioactivity. At almost every meeting of the government commission, Boris Shcherbina and his officials reproached them for their failure to find the fuel and questioned them about the continuing danger of a new self-sustaining chain reaction. At the beginning of 1988, they formed a new group, an interdisciplinary team of 30 scientists dedicated to exploring the sarcophagus and mapping what it contained, backed by a force of up to 3,500 construction workers, the Chernobyl Complex Expedition. Using horizontal drilling rigs extending up to 26 meters in length, operated by technicians from Sredmash and the Soviet mining industry, the complex expedition began boring deep within Unit 4, extracting core samples from the debris to examine the very fabric of the building. By the late spring of 1988, almost exactly 2 years after the explosion, the drilling had reached the reactor vessel itself. On May 3, a drill bit burst through the outer concrete wall of the shaft, passed through the layer of sand ballast, the steel walls of the inner protection tank, and at last, into the reactor vault. The scientists pushed a probe through the hole and toward the center of the vault in an attempt to gauge the parameters of the destruction in the graphite stacks and fuel assemblies of the reactor core, the origin point of the accident. But the probe encountered no resistance and traveled smoothly on across the full 11.8-meter diameter of the former active zone without pause or interruption. The scientists were bewildered. Where was the fuel? The following day, they inserted a periscope and a powerful lamp to illuminate the scene within, and were astonished by what they saw. The giant vault of reactor number 4, which had once contained 190 tons of uranium fuel and 1,700 tons of graphite blocks, and was since supposed to have been filled with load after load of sand, lead, and dolomite, was almost completely empty. In the course of an operation that would continue for years as they penetrated farther and farther into the warren of ruins within Unit 4, taking samples and photographs and shooting video footage of what they found, the men of the complex expedition unraveled the mystery of what had happened inside the building during the most feverish period of the Battle of Chernobyl. They discovered that only the smallest trace of the 17,000 tons of material eventually targeted on the building from above had found its mark inside the reactor vault. Instead, the majority of the loads were discovered in mounds up to 15 meters high, scattered elsewhere among the debris filling the central hall. Some lead ingots had struck the red and white striped vent stack, and the roof of Unit 3, almost 100 meters away from the target, had been smashed in by cargo dropped from the air. Moreover, it seemed that almost all of the 1,300 tons of graphite that had not been thrown from the reactor by the explosion had been consumed by fire. In the end, the blazing reactor had simply burned itself out. The Soviet flyers' courageous efforts to smother it with sand from 200 meters up had been almost entirely pointless. But the complex expedition also revealed that the theoretical physicists' terror of the China syndrome, initially dismissed as nearly impossible by the practically minded nuclear wildcatters of Sredmash, had not been so far-fetched after all. They established that the 2 tons of deadly compounds in the elephant's foot represented just a fraction of an incandescent river of radioactive lava that had formed inside the reactor in the minutes after the accident began and had flowed slowly downward into the basement of the building until the reactor vault itself was practically empty. The zirconium cladding of the fuel assemblies had melted first, reaching a temperature of more than 1,850 degrees Celsius within a half hour of the explosion, and dissolved the uranium dioxide pellets it contained, pooling into a hot metal soup that then absorbed parts of the reactor vessel itself, including stainless steel, serpentinite, graphite, and melted concrete. The radioactive lava, now containing some 135 tons of molten uranium, then began eating its way through the lower biological shield of the reactor, a massive steel disc filled with serpentinite gravel, weighing 1,200 tons. It burned clean through the shield and its contents, absorbing around a quarter of its total mass, and ran smoothly into the rooms below. The steel cross supporting the entire reactor vessel, Structure S, reached its yield point and buckled. The shield fell out from the bottom of the reactor, and the searing corium began burning a hole in the floor of the subreactor space. The pipes of the steam suppression system, which had proved unable to save reactor number 4 in its death throes, now provided a convenient path for the lava as it attempted to leave the building entirely, spreading out to the south and east along four separate routes. Melting metalwork, flowing through open doorways, slowly filling corridors and rooms, and creeping down through the plumbing, one floor after another, toward the foundations of Unit 4. By the time the corium reached the steam suppression pools, emptied at such great cost by Captain Zabrowski and the specialists from the plant, it had burned and seethed through three floors of the subreactor space, engorging itself with more parts of the building and structural debris, until it reached a combined weight of at least 1,000 tons. In some rooms, molten metal gathered in puddles 15 centimeters deep and solidified where it lay. And yet, despite the best efforts of Zabrowski and his men, several hundred cubic meters of water remained gathered in the suppression compartments, and it was not until the flow of corium reached this that the China syndrome finally came to an end. When the lava dropped into the dregs of the water in the suppression pool, it cooled harmlessly, and the molten heart of reactor number 4 at last ended its journey. A gray ceramic pumice floating on the surface of a radioactive pond, but just centimeters away from the foundations separating the building from the earth below. It would take the men of the complex expedition until 1990 to find most of the melted fuel and deliver a report assuring the government commission that the ghost of the reactor was unlikely, for the time being, to rise again. Even 4 years after the accident, the temperature inside some of the fuel clusters remained as high as 100 degrees Celsius. But unless it became saturated with water, the scientists calculated that a new criticality was almost impossible, and they installed a new monitoring system to give them an early warning if one did begin. By that time, the final implosion of the Soviet Union had started, and financial and political attention shifted far from Chernobyl. Increasingly forgotten and starved of resources, the complex expedition slogged on regardless. Its leader, the portly neutrino physicist Alexander Borovoy, would eventually make more than 1,000 trips into the sarcophagus. Borovoy said that he had always lacked physical courage and simply understood the dangers of radiation well enough to manage the risks, but each time he entered the great black building, it evoked in him the same feelings as the first moment of Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, an ominous prelude to a struggle between life and oblivion. The physicists lacked computers and protective equipment, and whenever he went inside, Borovoy carried a roll of medical tape with which to patch his plastic overalls in case of tears. Eventually, the man ran short even of underwear, and following the screening of a documentary about the expedition by the BBC, the scientists began receiving care packages of hand-knitted socks from the West. Borovoy handed these out as rewards to members of the group who distinguished themselves inside the sarcophagus. And yet the scientists found their work so fascinating and important that some refused to leave at the end of their assignments. Many deliberately left their dosimeters in the office to avoid officially registering their maximum dosages and being sent home. After the elephant's foot, they came upon other formations of solidified lava inside the ruins of Unit 4, frozen into uncanny shapes which they granted individual nicknames, the drop, the icicle, the stalagmite, and the heap. Among their unique discoveries was a new substance they christened Chernobylite, a beautiful but deadly blue crystal silicate composed of zirconium and uranium, which they chipped from the ruins. It could be examined safely only for short periods of time, and samples had to be removed from Unit 4 in lead-lined containers. And as money ran out and fears of a new self-sustaining chain reaction subsided, the complex expedition became aware of a new problem. The sarcophagus itself, built under conditions of great secrecy with all the haste and ingenuity the USSR could muster, was not proving quite the triumph of engineering the Soviet propaganda machine had claimed. Although the limitations of the building had been carefully concealed during its construction, Borovoy and his team now found gaps in the walls large enough for a man to pass through, and cracks through which water could penetrate and radioactive dust could escape. They also began to fear that inside the sarcophagus, what remained of the concrete skeleton of Unit 4 could soon collapse. By the time Borovoy was recalled to Moscow, it had become clear that a new means of protecting the world from the remains of the still-hot reactor would have to be found. Former plant director Viktor Bryukhanov walked free from prison on September 11, 1991, having served 5 years of his 10-year sentence, most of it in the penal colony in Donetsk. He was released early for good behavior under the rules of the Soviet judicial system and was permitted to spend the closing months of his punishment in compulsory labor, known as chemia, or chemistry, in Uman, a town closer to his wife Valentina in Kiev. At 55, he emerged from incarceration shattered and emaciated. The good Czech overcoat Valentina had brought him after her move to Kiev hung off him like a sack. When he came home, she showed him around their new apartment, in the same complex in the city where so many of his invalided colleagues and employees had been rehoused, by then becoming known as Little Pripyat, and introduced him to the 5-year-old granddaughter he had never met. Bryukhanov emerged into a profoundly changed world. The rigid certainties of the party he had served so unfailingly were dissolving, and even his popular infamy as the man responsible for the Chernobyl disaster was being swept away amid the revelations of higher and more unspeakable crimes. On December 26, 1991, the president of the Collegium on Criminal Cases of the USSR Supreme Court sent a 2-line letter to Bryukhanov's lawyer in Moscow, notifying him that the appeal against his client's sentence had been returned without review, since the state responsible for imposing it no longer existed. At first, Bryukhanov longed to return to Pripyat, and, in spite of everything that had happened, may have hoped to find a new job at the nuclear plant he had built. Eventually, Vitaly Sklarov, the sardonic former apparatchik still overseeing the Ukrainian Ministry of Energy, now part of the independent national government, found Bryukhanov a position with the ministry's Body for International Trade in Kiev. In early 1992, he quietly went back to work, a forgotten man. The fallen director was the last of the Chernobyl plant staff punished for their part in the explosion of reactor number 4 to be set free. Kovalenko and Rogoshkin had successfully petitioned for early release and already returned to jobs at the plant. The former nuclear safety inspector, Laushkin, had also been released but died of stomach cancer soon afterward. Chief engineer Nikolai Fomin had never fully recovered from the shock of the accident. 2 years after his arrest in 1988, he was diagnosed with a reactive psychosis and transferred to a psychiatric hospital. Granted early release for health reasons in 1990, Fomin found work again at the Kalinin nuclear power plant north of Moscow, although even then his mental state reportedly remained fragile. Anatoly Dyatlov, the dictatorial deputy chief engineer, had spent his years of incarceration contesting the verdict of the Soviet court, writing letters and giving interviews from prison, in an attempt to publicize what he'd learned about the failings of the RBMK reactor and clear his name and those of his staff. He wrote directly to Hans Blix at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna to point out the failings of their technical analysis, but also to the parents of Leonid Toptanov, describing how their son had stayed at his post to try to save the crippled reactor and how he had been unjustly blamed for causing the accident. He explained that the reactor should never have been put into operation and that Toptanov and his dead colleagues were the victims of a judicial cover-up. "I fully sympathize with you and grieve with you," Dyatlov wrote. "There is nothing more unbearable than losing one's child." In prison, Dyatlov continued to suffer from the terrible radiation burns he had sustained as he wandered through the wreckage of Unit 4 on the night of the accident, and in October 1990 was also granted early release due to his declining health. From his flat in Troyeshina, the increasingly frail engineer continued a campaign to reveal the truth about the design faults of the reactor and the way the accident had been whitewashed by academician Legasov and the Soviet delegation to the IAEA. Despite the publication of popular accounts, including Grigory Medvedev's Chernobyl notebook, which called into question the official Soviet version of the story, the government commission's reports into the causes of the accident remained classified, and the public perception of events remained unchanged. That of a perfectly reliable reactor blown up by incompetent operators. But as the bonds of the secret state began to loosen further, the truth about the origins of the explosion in Unit 4 at last started to emerge. In the face of opposition from Nikiet and the Ministry of Atomic Energy, the state's independent nuclear safety board belatedly launched its own inquiry into the causes of the accident. The board sought advice from both mid-level members of the RBMK design team and former specialists from the Chernobyl plant. The leader of the Board of Inquiry began an intensive correspondence with Dyatlov about the events immediately leading up to the explosion. Incidental documents submitted by the Soviet authorities to the IAEA had already begun to undermine the official version, and in July 1990, one senior member of the original Soviet delegation to Vienna admitted publicly that the designers had been chiefly to blame for the catastrophe, and the operators' actions played only a minor role. The report that the Nuclear Safety Board of Inquiry delivered to the Soviet Council of Ministers in January 1991 completely contradicted the story Legasov had told the IAEA in 1986 of a delicate piece of equipment blown up by feckless operators who breached one vital safety regulation after another. Their findings couldn't entirely vindicate Dyatlov, who maintained not only that the plant personnel had nothing to do with the accident, but also that at the fateful moment in its development, when Leonid Toptanov raised the reactor power from zero so that the rundown test could take place, he hadn't even been in the room. But they made clear that although the actions of the operators contributed to what happened, they should not be held responsible for a disaster that was decades in the making. In May 1991, while the report was still under review by the Fuel and Energy Department of the Council of Ministers, one of its principal authors, former Chernobyl chief engineer Nikolai Steinberg, presented his findings to the inaugural International Congress on Human Rights, held by Moscow's Sakharov Center. He told the delegates that the origins of the Chernobyl disaster lay in a combination of scientific, technological, socioeconomic, and human factors unique to the USSR. The Soviet nuclear industry, lacking even rudimentary safety practices, had relied upon its operators to behave with robotic precision night after night, despite constant pressure to beat deadlines and exceed the plan, that made disregard for the letter of the regulations almost inevitable. He reported that Dyatlov and the now deceased operators in control room number 4 had brought the reactor into an unstable condition, but only on account of the acute pressure they felt to complete the test on the turbine. Under those circumstances, Steinberg said, the unit operators and managers made a decision that, in all probability, predetermined the subsequent accident. But nobody could know for sure, because they had still not determined whether, once the test began, the reactor might have been shut down without risking disaster. Although Dyatlov, shift foreman Akimov, and senior reactor control engineer Toptanov had violated some operating regulations, they were ignorant of the deadly failing of the RBMK-1000 that meant that insertion of the control rods, instead of shutting down the reactor at the end of the test, could initiate a runaway chain reaction. Every one of the investigators behind the report now agreed that the fatal power surge that destroyed the reactor had begun with the entry of the rods into its core. Thus, the Chernobyl accident comes within the standard pattern of most severe accidents in the world. It begins with an accumulation of small breaches of the regulations. These produce a set of undesirable properties and occurrences that, when taken separately, do not seem to be particularly dangerous. But finally, an initiating event occurs that, in this particular case, was the subjective actions of the personnel that allowed the potentially destructive and dangerous qualities of the reactor to be released. Steinberg recognized that the origins of the accident lay with those who had designed the reactor and the secret, incestuous bureaucracy that had allowed it to go into operation, but he concluded that it was no longer constructive to allocate blame, whether with those who hang a rifle on the wall, aware that it is loaded, or those who inadvertently pull the trigger. But the barons of the atomic industry had no more appetite for the truth than they had 5 years earlier. The Kremlin's nuclear minister did not immediately accept the findings in Steinberg's report, but instead ordered up a second investigation from a new commission, this time packed with the same men behind the Vienna report of 1986. Under pressure from the reactor designer,